It's Wednesday, March 18th, and welcome to Higher IQ. The NCAA tournament bracket dropped on Sunday. 68 teams, 3 weeks, and roughly $1.1 billion in television revenue. If you filled out a bracket this week, you're one of about 40 million Americans who did. And if you took any time off work to watch first-round games, you're part of what economists estimate is billions of dollars in lost productivity every March. The NCAA has turned this tournament into one of the most valuable properties in American sports. But the system it's built on has a history that most fans have never heard, and it starts not with basketball, but with rowing in Victorian England. Today, we're going to explain where the money actually goes in March Madness, how the concept of the amateur athlete was invented, and why a phrase coined to deny a dead football player's widow workers compensation became the foundation of a billion-dollar industry. This is Higher IQ. The NCAA generated a record $1.57 billion in total revenue in its most recent fiscal year. More than a billion of that came from media deals, and the overwhelming majority of the media money comes from one contract, the CBS and Turner deal, to broadcast the men's basketball tournament. That deal, which runs through 2032, pays the NCAA an average of $1.1 billion a year. A 30-second commercial during a key March Madness game costs around $2 million, putting it in the same tier as the Super Bowl. The NCAA doesn't control the college football playoff or any major bowl games, which means this single 3-week basketball tournament funds the vast majority of everything the organization does. The money flows through a system the NCAA calls units. Every game a team plays in the tournament earns its conference a unit worth roughly $2 million, paid out over 6 years. The conference, not the school, collects the money and distributes it to member institutions. Most conferences split it evenly, which means when a 16 seed pulls off a first-round upset, the financial benefit goes to the entire conference, including the teams that didn't make the tournament at all. Schools reinvest the money into athletic facilities, coaching salaries, travel, and scholarships across all sports, not just basketball. About 60% of the NCAA's annual revenue, roughly $600 million, flows back to Division I schools and conferences. The head coaches at the top programs earn millions. The NCAA's own leadership is handsomely compensated. Everyone in the system gets paid except the people who generate the product. That arrangement has a name, amateurism, and it has a history that has nothing to do with sportsmanship. The modern concept of amateurism was invented in 19th century Victorian England. It had nothing to do with the ancient Greeks, despite what the mythology suggests. Ancient Olympic athletes competed for cash, prizes, political appointments, and fame. The closest ancient Greek word for amateur was idiots, and the translation is exactly what you think it is. The Victorian version of amateurism was a class project. During the Industrial Revolution, the British upper classes noticed something inconvenient. Working-class men, hardened by farm and factory labor, were physically stronger than the aristocrats who ran the rowing clubs and cricket leagues. The solution was to invent a rule that said anyone who worked with their hands for a living was, by definition, not an amateur, and therefore ineligible to compete. Amateurism wasn't about purity. It was about keeping the wrong people out. This ideology took root at Oxford and Cambridge, crossed the Atlantic to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, and became the philosophical foundation of American college sports. The NCAA was formed in 1906, originally to address the fact that 18 college football players had died in a single season. But from the start, the organization embedded British-style amateurism into its rules. Athletes could not be paid. They competed, in the NCAA's own 1916 definition, purely for the enjoyment and developing their mental, physical, moral, and social skills. The rule that said athletes couldn't make money never applied to the institutions. As early as the 1880s, schools were charging admission to football games. By the 1920s, full-ride athletic scholarships were an open secret. The 1929 Carnegie Report studied 112 college athletic programs and found commercialism running through all of them. The money was already flowing. It just wasn't flowing to players. In the 1950s, a man named Walter Byers became the NCAA's first executive director. Byers is the person who coined the phrase student athlete. He didn't invent it as a term of respect. He invented it as a legal shield. In 1955, a football player named Ray Dennison died from a head injury sustained while playing for Fort Lewis A&M in Colorado. His widow filed for workers' compensation death benefits. If Dennison was an employee of the university, she had a case. Byers and the NCAA created student athletes specifically to argue that college players were students first and athletes second, not employees, and therefore not entitled to workplace protections. The term was embedded into every NCAA rule and interpretation. It worked. Dennison's widow lost her claim. And for the next 70 years, student athlete served as the legal and rhetorical foundation for a system that generated billions while classifying the people doing the work as something other than workers. Byers himself eventually turned against the system he built. Late in his career, he wrote that collegiate amateurism is not a moral issue, it is an economic camouflage for monopoly practice. His colleagues were, in his words, aghast, as though he had desecrated sacred vows. Things are changing, slowly. In 2021, the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 in NCAA v. Alston that the NCAA could not restrict education-related benefits to athletes. Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote in his concurrence, "Nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay their workers a fair market rate on the theory that their product is defined by not paying their workers a fair market rate." That same year, NIL rules went into effect, allowing college athletes to earn money from their name, image, and likeness first time. Top players now sign 6- and 7-figure endorsement deals. Livy Dunn, a gymnast at LSU, reportedly earned more from NIL than any coach in her sport. A settlement currently being finalized would allow universities to pay athletes directly, with revenue sharing projected to start as early as this year, capping at roughly $22 million per school annually. That sounds like a lot until you compare it to what the schools themselves generate. The University of Texas Athletic Department reported over $250 million in revenue in 2024. The athletes would be getting less than 10% of the total. But the tournament's fundamental structure hasn't changed. The TV deal still pays the NCAA, not the players. The unit system still distributes money to conferences, not to the athletes whose performances determine the payout. A player who hits a buzzer beater in the first round generates $2 million in conference revenue over 6 years and receives none of it directly. The billion-dollar bracket pool, the advertising deals, the lost productivity that economists calculate every March, all of it is built on the labor of athletes who, until very recently, couldn't legally earn a dollar from their own performance. NIL has opened a door, but the economic structure of the tournament itself remains largely intact. And the betting market has added another layer entirely. An estimated $15.5 billion was wagered on March Madness in 2024. Legalized sports betting has turned casual viewers into engaged ones because people with money on a game watch the entire thing. That drives viewership, which drives TV ratings, which drives the value of the CBS-Turner contract, which funds the NCAA. You can't watch a tournament game now without seeing ads for DraftKings or FanDuel, companies that profit directly from the performance of athletes who, until 4 years ago, couldn't legally earn money from their own names. The fans filling out brackets, the offices running pools, the sportsbooks taking action, they're all feeding a revenue engine whose underlying logic traces back to a Victorian-era rule designed to keep working-class rowers out of the regatta. So when you're watching the tournament this week, here's what's behind the bracket. March Madness generates over $1 billion a year in TV revenue alone. The concept of amateurism that kept players from being paid was invented in Victorian England to exclude the working class from competing against aristocrats. The phrase student athlete was coined in the 1950s to deny a dead football player's widow workers' compensation. The Supreme Court ruled 9-0 that the NCAA's compensation restrictions violated antitrust law. And the man who built the system spent his final years calling it economic camouflage for monopoly practice. The brackets are fun. The economics are a different game entirely. Stay informed, stay curious, and we'll see you tomorrow.